Good morning and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. I am now honored to introduce Peggy Chase as she will introduce this morning's speaker. Peggy graduated from SUNY Upstate College of Nursing and holds a doctorate from SU in Education Administration. During her long career, she has held management and education positions at Upstate, St. Joe's, and Community General. Peggy was also an adjunct nursing professor at SU, SUNY Upstate, Morrisville, and Keuka College. In retirement, Peggy sits on the New York State Education Department Nurse Board, dealing with professional policy and discipline issues, and in 2013 was elected to the Onondaga County Legislature for the 9th District, which is totally within the city. She also sits on several boards, mostly related to kids or healthcare. Please join me in welcoming Peggy Chase.
Good morning. I'm privileged to introduce our speaker this morning. Grant Rear is the director of Campbell Public Affairs Institute and professor of political science at Syracuse University's Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs. His research and teaching interests are primarily in American politics and political history, with an emphasis on legislative politics, democratic representation, and active citizenship. He has published many books and articles, including pieces in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Ottawa Citizen, Newsday, the Philadelphia Inquirer, Milwaukee Journal. At various points, he has been the regular columnist for Syracuse Post-Standard. He has also been quoted in many newspaper stories, including pieces appearing in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, the Financial Times, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Dallas Morning News, Newsday, and Roll Call. Recently, he's been a regular expert commentator for The Hill and The Washington Examiner, two prominent inside the Beltway publications. Grant is a 1982 graduate of Dartmouth and earned a PhD in 1992 from Yale University. In addition to his work at Syracuse University, he is creator, host, and producer of The Campbell Conversation, the WRVO Public Media, a weekly regional national public radio public affairs show featuring extended in-depth interviews with regional and national writers, politicians, activists, public officials, and business professionals. He has also arranged and hosted candidate debates on the program. The program has won awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association, the New York State Associated Press, and the Syracuse Press Club for Best Special Program, Best Interview, and Public Service. Please help me in welcoming Grant Rear.
Thanks, Peggy. Thanks to you also, Peggy, not only for the introduction, but for the hosting of the interns from my class that you've done. I really appreciate that, and I hope we can continue that. It's really a pleasure to be here today. I haven't engaged with the group for a while. I think the last time I was with Thursday Morning Roundtable, we were at the zoo, and it was the mayor's candidates forum, so it's good to be back. I'm a little worried and leery about this topic. I assume that you have not waited all this time for me to tell you who won the midterms, but I'm struggling to think of things to say about it that haven't already been said 8,000 times and looked at in different ways. And so What I thought I would do is to offer basically four sets of comments about it, just giving some overall general reflections, some personal reflections, and then see where the conversation goes from there. And you know, because I'm not sure what it is that you want to pursue. And also, I was talking to Dana Balter before the program started here this morning, and it reminded me of being at a New England political science conference years ago. I think it might have been in, 1992 or 93, somewhere in there, and it was a panel on presidential elections, and there sitting in the audience was Michael Dukakis. And one of the authors of the paper said, it's kind of strange to have a data point sitting in front of me here. So we might want to talk about the 24th, and if we do, then we know who we can ask. So and I also want to thank Emily for the invitation to come and speak to you. So let me try to make four sets of general comments about the elections, at least from now a month plus later, and then again see where the conversation takes us from there. What I wanted to talk about first was just some basic facts, and I think some of the most important kind of takeaways from some of the aspects of the election, which I'm titling this first chapter, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I was just actually watching that movie the other day, so it's in my mind. Start with the good. The midterm election set a modern record for turnout, and the turnout level in some ways rivaled some of our lower turnouts in recent years for presidential elections, which is really, really quite striking. And in some particular districts, and we're one of them, the turnout rate was very, very high. So I think this is something that is a good thing. It bodes well for the future. It bodes well for our civic engagement. Secondly, and in the same vein, there were a record number of women elected. And again, I'm telling you things I'm sure you've already heard. But a record number of women elected at the national level. The Congress is going to look more diverse and more like the United States than it ever has before. And this was generally a phenomenon that was on the Democratic side of things. But I think it is something that both parties certainly have taken note of. And I think it's something that they're both going to be emphasizing as we go forward. And the other thing in the good was that many of the candidates, and again, I think we've got one in this room, were first-time candidates, first time to really get seriously involved in something and throw their hats in the ring. And again, that suggests that something important is going on in this country's civic life that I hope is something that will continue and be a permanent feature and not something that is just driven by one particular moment in time. So that's all the good. On the bad and the ugly, I think it's also fair to say that the electoral process this time was distinctively marked by things that the public has said over and over again over recent history that they don't like about politics and our political system. And I think there was a widespread level of mutual disrespect and disdain and anger. Anger is not always a bad thing, civically, but I think that also can have a corrosive effect, and I think there was evidence of that looking at the candidates and even looking at some of the messages from the activists. Some of the campaign messaging in different districts and in different races ranged from the false to the sleazy. And I think that's another instance of the bad and the ugly there. Another concern that I would have about this is that the overall pattern in the outcomes from the election certainly indicated pretty strongly that the country is becoming further polarized and that the kind of division that we're seeing and separation that we're seeing in the country between Democrats and Republicans, the fact that people who in previous decades might have told a survey, might have answered a survey that they lean in one party or another, that would suggest that they might cross party lines. That seems to be largely a thing of the past, at least for now, that if someone tells you that they lean Democrat or Republican, that basically means they're always voting in that way. And that those lines then became, I think, even starker. And in terms of the geography, and I'll say more about this in a minute, but in terms of the geography and the way that we sort ourselves as citizens, that those lines became even starker as well in terms of what divides us. So that's a concern. Democrats with Democrats, Republicans with Republicans. And while there were a spate of Democratic victories for Congress by moderates in the general election, there also were a number of moderates, particularly in the primaries, but also in the general election, who lost because they were moderate. And so that, again, underlines that kind of trend. So that's kind of the good, the bad, and the ugly, as I see it, is what came out of the midterms for at least our civic life and for us as citizens. Now, second chapter, thinking about some of the results here more specifically. Again, I'm not going to, you know, I don't think you need to tell me who won, who lost, what the composition of the House of Representatives and the Senate is and how it changed. What I think is a little more deeply diving into it of interest and note is that the Democrats increased their inroads into the suburbs. And this was a trend we already saw, but that the Democrats did quite well in the suburbs. And in fact, if you're looking at sort of relative losses compared to years past, that's where the Republicans took their biggest hit, was in the suburbs. And it's a particular kind of suburb where these losses seem to be most pronounced and where this division can be seen. And this, as I'm taking some of this from Alan Greenblatt, who's a writer for Governing Magazine, but he's got it from other places, and so we're both kind of drawing on these little factoids here. But there's a couple that I think are interesting that indicate this in terms of the idea that there's a certain kind of suburb that is driving this. One analysis after the midterms found that 70% of the districts where the Democrats were able to flip a seat that had been held by the GOP coming into 2018, 70% of those districts had a Whole Foods in them. districts that did not flip, only 40% of those districts had a Whole Foods. So it's a pretty significant difference.
Is that the same as white Wegmans?
Well, I had that exact question. The question is that the same as Wegmans? And I had that question in my own mind. I thought, well, where does Wegmans fit into this? I don't know. That's an interesting question. I think Wegmans probably has a more diverse. I was thinking more maybe Trader Joe's as a thing, but Trader, it's a different kind of thing. But it's getting at a similar vibe. It's a different kind of different price point. That's for sure. But anyway, here's another one, and this is looking at 1992 and comparing it to the presidential election year of 2016. But the gap in voting between Republicans and Democrats, if you look at counties where there's a Cracker Barrel versus counties where there is a Whole Foods, the gap there in the voting was 20% in 1992, okay, in terms of the difference between Republicans and Democrats, 54% in 2016. So there's a cultural, the point here is that there's a cultural division going on here that aligns with our political divisions, and I think concerns me because that really cements that kind of division, and it's not clear to me how we're going to get out of it. So that's the first thing, thinking about the suburbs. The other overall pattern, and you've all heard this, of course, is that the Democrats, I think, exceeded what the usual historical expectations were for a midterm election in the first term of a new president's term in terms of the House, and they underperformed in the Senate. But if you look at the particular Senate races and where those states were and the dynamics in those races, then that story becomes a bit more complicated. But certainly if you're just looking for numbers, you know, the Republicans had a good night in the Senate and not so good night in the House. The elections seem to be a referendum on Trump. Not a deep statement there. It seemed to be a loss for Trump to some extent, but I'll come back to that in a minute. I'm not so sure that that is as complete a loss as it might have first appeared. Now, the other thing to point out, and it has to do with this problem of sorting and division and polarization, is that at the state level, this kind of separation was playing out again. And this got less attention. But again, you see more extreme sorting there. There's a word that analysts of state elections use in looking at the composition of state legislatures and the governor's seats use to get at this called trifectas. And that's where you've got basically unified control of the government. You've got a governor, and then the House and the Senate, or whatever they're called in that particular state, all controlled by the same party. And this has varied over time, but we're in a period where there's a lot of these trifectas, and 2018 produced more of them. So now there are only 13 states that don't have unified control of the government. That is a historical high water mark. We've reached it before, relatively recently in our past, and then fallen down away from it, but we're back to 13 now. What's more striking is if you look at the percentage of population living in these different states and categorizing them by whether they're trifectas or not, the percentage of the population living under divided government at the state level went from 31.3% prior to 2018. Now it will be, come January, 23.5%. And that is very high relative to our past. The other thing I would say, this is totally qualitative and totally impression on my part, but you know, I've been watching these elections for a long time, actually, frankly, since I was 8, pretty seriously. I actually went door to door for candidates when I was 8. My mother was a precinct captain in Virginia, and so she enlisted me to go do that. And it was fun. People kind of thought it was weird, this 8-year-old knocking at their door, handing out literature, talking about the candidates. But anyway, since I was 8, I've never seen elections at a state level that have been so driven by the national level and have been so driven by a president, by any individual. It's really striking to me. And it was just not in New York. I mean, it was clear in New York. If you're watching messaging and state elections in New York, it was hard to figure out who the person was running against if they were a Democrat. It seemed like they were running against Donald Trump, even if they were running for the state assembly. Certainly Andrew Cuomo was running against Donald Trump. So, but it was across the country. I've looked at messaging all across the country at the state level, and it just repeats itself. State attorneys general, governors, even very down ballot races. I've never seen something so driven and about the national picture. So that's the second chapter. Third chapter, what does all this mean? What does it mean going forward? Well, immediately on that night, and I was doing coverage for WRVO that night, I made this point, and then immediately realized the day after that it was the wrong point to make. But it did seem like perhaps there was an opening for greater cooperation and some common ground at the national level in thinking about how this might change some of the incentive structures and the dynamics for the two parties and for the president and for the Democratic leadership in the House and the Democratic leadership in the Senate, that you might see some more cooperation. And immediately one of the things came to mind that's, you know, already been on people's lips is infrastructure. You might see something in infrastructure here. This is something that both parties have expressed interest in, the president has expressed interest in. So they might think that the next 2 years might be a time when something like that could be done. The big one for me that I thought was enticing was thinking about maybe this is a moment where you could get something that Obamacare explicitly did not pursue, which was the negotiation of prices for drugs and the Medicare program. Now that sounds like a kind of a detail thing, but it's something that healthcare analysts and scholars have talked about for a very long time. It's striking that it doesn't exist for this program. There is something like it that does exist for Medicaid. And if you could have it in Medicare, it could have an enormous ripple effect all through the entire healthcare system. And it's something that President Trump has expressed interest in, and it's something that Democrats, at least on paper, are in favor of. But again, in the negotiation for Obamacare, the president and the administration explicitly took that off the table and basically a deal with the insurance companies and pharma in order to get their buy-in on this. And so they were providing more customers and more business for those corporate entities in exchange for getting more access and expanding the Medicaid program and not getting the pushback on the exchanges. But that was something that was kind of left there, and there was a thought, in my mind anyway, that this might be a moment to do that because the Republicans could emphasize, here we're trying to cut costs, and here's a way that we're trying to sort of tamp down the overall size of this program. And the Democrats could say, here's a way that we have, in a sense, indirectly, but importantly, expanded access to the healthcare system for more people through lower drug pricing. That doesn't seem like that's going to be on the table. And then the other one, sort of the holy grail of all this would be, well, maybe this is a moment where you could get an immigration deal. You could do what George W. Bush tried to do and could not, but the last couple days have really sort of shot that one down pretty completely. So anyway, all right, so that was the hope. Here's what seems to be the likely reality. The trenches have already been dug, they've been dug deeper now, and now they're just gonna be more thoroughly manned. It looks like we're in for 2 years of pretty hard, cold conflict that will make the previous 2 years of conflict look like perhaps the good old days. That's what I'm worried about. But with this meeting that the president just had with Senator Schumer and Speaker-to-be Pelosi, that's certainly what it looks like. I thought it was, I'm editorializing now, but I thought it was a pretty soul-crushing performance all around. So that's where we are. The last thing I'll say about this, what does it all mean? I do think, though, that, and we can talk more about this, I'm being a little deliberately provocative, perhaps, but I do think the rumors of Donald Trump's impending defeat in 2020 are being greatly exaggerated, to paraphrase Mark Twain. So it's not clear to me that that's what the midterm showed, although that's what a lot of pundits are taking out of it. Let's look at the state of New York, and then I'll stop. And actually, since we've got the data point here, the Dana point, maybe you should ask me about the 24th and the 22nd and think about those two districts. I do have something to say about that. I don't know. We'll see. See what you want to talk about. But at the state level, okay, so New York is one of these new trifectas. It's going to have unified party control of its government that it hasn't had before. Well, it had it for a couple of years, but the Democrats were so dysfunctional in the Senate that I really don't count that. So it's going to have a new trifecta. The Democratic Party's center of weight in the Senate is, first of all, they've got a healthier majority than a lot of people expected they would have. Second of all, though, the center of weight in that party has moved decidedly to the left. And certainly in terms of the Senate as a whole, as an institution, the center of weight has moved decidedly downstate. What is that going to mean? Well, I think there are some things that are likely that have been sort of being pushed by advocacy groups in recent years, and now, you know, the moment is here. The opportunity window has opened, and I think that folks are going to step through it. I think we are going to see some, what could be some pretty significant and important government reforms in terms of ethics and transparency. I think we could see some pretty important reforms in terms of the electoral system, and I think we could see some pretty important reforms in terms of campaigns and how they are financed and how they are conducted. And so those are things I think that are kind of the low, to use this cliche I don't like, but I'm gonna use it, kind of the low-hanging fruit policy-wise that the Senate could grab and the governor could go along with, although he's been somewhat less enthusiastic of a supporter about some of these things in the past. I mean, he's on paper he's enthusiastic, but then, you know, it's not clear that those things really get pushed. So these could be things that could be done. Codifying the protections for women's reproductive rights and Roe versus Wade into law in New York they're already there in a lot of ways, but further doing that and making a statement about that. The big one, of course, that I think has a huge question mark next to it is the New York Health Act. And I think this is going to be where both the governor and this Democratic caucus in the Senate are going to have some gut checks and soul searching to do. Because you have a lot of folks who have gone on record as being in favor of this. You have a lot of Democrats in the Assembly who have voted for this in the past, knowing that it would never come to fruition. Now it's real. And before, this thing, I think, was largely a symbolic. And when I'm talking about the Health Act, by the way, I won't go into the details of this, but basically it's a provision to turn New York State into its own single-payer system and to have a state-funded and state-run, although there's debate about whether it'd be state-run. In effect, I think it's going to be state-run because they'd have to control the money. State-run healthcare program for all of us living in the state. I think this is going to be, though, a problem because in the past, the support for that in large respect has been symbolic for many elected officials. And I don't mean that in a pejorative way. What they're doing is they're signaling to their constituents that they have certain beliefs and values about access to health care. And that's the way to signal that in a shorthand way. But that was under the conditions where this was not going to happen. Now it's really, really real. The votes are there. And the new Democrats in the Senate, particularly the ones that unseated the IDC member incumbents, like Rachel May, put this front and center in their campaigns. And in fact, Rachel May's argument against Dave Valesky on this act, and it was one of her major themes, was that even though Senator Valesky was in favor of the Health Act, again, he said, I support this. Her argument was, well, you said you supported it, but you didn't really work very hard to pass it. In other words, it was a symbolic position and not something you really work for. I'm going to really work for it. Okay, so they've run on this. That's their pledge. Now they're in office, and now what? And I think this thing is going to be a lot more complicated and a lot more difficult to pass than a lot of the supporters realize. The governor has already backed away from it. And my own personal prediction on this is that this is going to be something, in a sense, that's going to be traded for other things. In other words, we will slow walk this. We will have maybe a commission looking at the price structure and thinking about the financing, and it'll basically go away, and we'll pass these other things instead. That's my own personal prediction, but I think it's going to put the governor and the new members in interesting and difficult positions. And one of the reasons why I think it will put the governor in a difficult position, of course, is that, you know, if he's not thinking about running for president, other people are thinking about him running for president. And so there is a positioning issue that goes on, and I think he's already about as far to the left as a presidential candidate hopeful would want to be in the next election cycle. We can debate that, and maybe some of you will want to debate that, but I think that's something that's on his mind if he's thinking about that. So those are my thoughts. I took longer than I thought I would, but anyway, I'll curious to hear what you want to hear about.
What I was curious about, in my memory, we had more undecided contests at the end of the election cycle than we have previously. We've always had one or two interesting ones. And this leads me to how do we affect states who have lousy voting systems? We can affect New York State, but since elections are run by states and not by the federal government, how do we make sure that all citizens have the right to vote?
Well, I'll take issue with the last thing you said, if I heard you right. You said elections are run not by the states, but by the federal. Oh, you're right. Yes, you're right. That's the interesting thing. And, you know, one of the things I give a lot of lectures to folks from other countries that come here to learn about American politics in a short period of time. And it's interesting. It's like a flashback to high school, because the debate question in high school always was, should we abolish the Electoral College? And here we go again. We're always there. But that's one of the things I always want to know. What's up with the Electoral College? I don't understand that. But one of the things that they also don't realize is we do not have a national election for president. We have 50 state elections for president that all happen to occur on the same day. So yeah, what can we do? Well, I think that, first of all, I think we had a lot of those late decided elections because there were so many that were close. So I think that's the first thing driving it. But you're right to identify there are all sorts of problems across the country with our electoral system, and there are things that are of particular concern that have been changed recently to make it harder for people to vote. And there is debate about whether that is being driven by partisan considerations. Certainly, if you look at who's making the arguments and where those changes are occurring, it's hard to argue that there's probably not something there in terms of that. But there are other kinds of problems too. New York is one of the worst. We're so restrictive in our voting rules, particularly when it comes to primaries and voter registration. We're an outlier that way. So, you know, I think hopefully, and I go back to where I started with the hopeful. You had this huge influx of activism. You had this huge influx of people paying attention and paying attention enough to go and vote in a midterm at a much higher rate than ever before. So maybe that will carry through in terms of pressure to make changes to the electoral system. I mean, my changes were never happen, and they're just pie in the sky kind of things. But one of the things that we could do is simply to move the election to a Sunday instead of having it on a work day. And you know, the reason why it's on a Tuesday goes back to the fact that the country was agricultural and we, you know, primarily in farming communities and all that kind of thing. Well, those days are largely over in terms of the entire country and the population. I think we could take a lesson from Europe, have the elections on a Sunday, or at least make it a real holiday so that more people could have an easier time to get to the polls, and it would be more of a focusing event for folks. I also would move it to the 4th of July instead of November, but that's a bigger problem. But I've always liked that idea. So I don't know if you remember.
And ruined by vacation.
What's that?
Yeah,
there is that. There is the summer vacation, but that's what mail ballots are for, you know. So, so anyway, but yeah, no, I agree with you. I think, you know, and that's just activism that's going to have to take place, and reform is going to have to take place in 50 different places, 51 different places at the same time.
Good morning. I have a comment and a question. The comment is, we talked about state as opposed to national elections. I would suggest that in many respects, it's by county that really dictates, as we saw in a lot of races, is how the counties set up those ballots, et cetera, to make a difference, even for presidential or U.S. senator or any candidates. Yeah. My question really goes to the enigma that I see as Donald Trump.
Okay.
Even he didn't think he was going to win, I think, in 2016.
I think that's clear, yeah.
Yeah, but he did. And for the last 2 years, he's done a lot of things. And yet he seems to have a real stranglehold on that quote that he always refers to as core support. And you had a Congress that was unwilling or unable to challenge him in any way when they were seriously opposed to what he was doing. Is there some secret about him that I can't see that enables him to continue to have this hold on voters and Congress?
I think it's the hair. No, I would locate that in a longer standing feature of our politics in recent history. And that's what I alluded to before, is the political polarization. I would take issue a little bit in a friendly way with the premise of the question. And that's that Donald Trump has this particular hold. I don't think so. I think the division in the country has a particular hold on us. And so, and I've said this all along, our country is so polarized right now, and I'm talking about the citizens as well as those that occupy the offices, it doesn't really matter who's running. They're both going to start with 43%. I mean, you could nominate a ham sandwich for president. That ham sandwich is going to get 43%. It's that other little sliver that they're arguing. So I don't think Donald Trump, first of all, has this kind of mystique about this. He's drawing on the fact that the lines are so hard right now that there's that core of support is ultimately driven by that division more than an affinity for Donald Trump, okay? I mean, just look at the way the primary played out. It was completely fractured, right? It was completely fractured, and he emerges as kind of the winner in a plurality kind of way. Having said that, I think there are certain things that he does say and represents that do speak to certain people in a very deep way that then within that first group that I've carved out amplify the loyalty and the attachment. And that is the thing, these are things that have been, you know, talked about a lot by pundits and also scholars looking at this, but certainly there are some tectonic changes in our economy over the last 40 years that have really either left a lot of people behind or really eroded a sense of confidence and stability for other people in terms of their economic lives and their futures. And the Democratic Party hasn't really spoken to that in powerful ways. They've tried in stumbling ways. You know, Bill Clinton, people who work hard, play by the rules, that's kind of what he's trying to get at. But they haven't really focused an appeal and a message that really speaks to that. Trump did. And that, and there's a cultural aspect to this as well. I mean, I was making light of the Cracker Barrel Whole Foods thing, but there's something real to that. Democrats have a problem in that regard. It's ironic, though, that a billionaire who has the business history and life history that he has is going to be the one that's going to tap that. But it's clear that Hillary Clinton was not going to tap that. I mean, she just came across as an urban Eastern elite. It just oozed out of her and her campaign. And so he's tapped that in a way, I think, that has spoken to people. And so I think there's a loyalty that comes from that that is almost not even attached to the policies. It's a symbolic kind of cultural thing, a rhetorical thing, but that matters for folks. So I would say that's the thing. And then the other thing is this. I've always said you need when you're thinking about this president, you need to separate out the rhetorical president from the policy president. Now, it's hard with him because the whole thing kind of gets wrapped together, but I do think it's still important to separate it out. Donald Trump as a policy president, I don't think merits some of the, and here I'm going to be deliberately provocative, but there is among some Democrats a hysteria to the reaction. And I don't think that it's always merited. It's almost like any change from the past is outrageous and completely illegitimate. Well, you know, as Barack Obama said to John Boehner in their first meeting in the Oval Office, John, we had an election and I won. Well, we had an election and he won. So there's going to be some policy changes. And I think if you add them all up and you compare them to Reagan's first term or George W. Bush, you know, it's not like this thing stands way out there. The rhetorical presidency, though, is on another solar system. I mean, it's something we've never seen before. And that's what I think gets people really going. But there's a piece of that rhetorical presidency that does appeal to people, and that is just the complete absence of any kind of dressing up and any kind of nuance and any kind of sort of politician speak. He just doesn't have it. And that's been something that drives people crazy and they think is unpresidential, but it's also something that a lot of people really like. And again, you know, people do this all the time when they're talking in this way, but you know, I do have in-laws, okay, and I'm listening to what they're saying, and that's one of the things that they like. You know, and they feel that's really important to them that he does that. So that's my That's my take on it. Of course, you could make arguments to say everything I just said has a really awful side to it, and I get that. And I want to make it clear, in no way am I trying to defend or advocate for the president. That's not what I'm doing here. But I do think that those are some of the things that appeal to people. One last, I've gone on, I'm filibustering on this one, but one last thing I would say, and again, maybe being a little bit deliberately provocative, but I did have this thought in the first couple months, and I've rethought it a lot now. But if we remember a Barack Obama press conference, if you can remember those, okay, I think that they were entirely useless. He'd let the reporters ask 3-4-part questions, and then he would spend 15 minutes not answering them. They just didn't really provide citizens with anything useful. You can't say that about Donald Trump's press conferences. He's saying stuff. He's making points, and he's getting into it with the reporters. And so again, I think people, you know, the people like that.
Okay, I've got to thank you for that last part. It was very thoughtful, and I hope that everyone's strategic. I think we all pray for strategy and good governing from here on. But I did want to ask a couple of quick things. One would be, is what's the impact of the Georgia gubernatorial dispute that's going on? It's hard for us, all of us, to keep up with it, but hopefully that has some implications in terms of voting. And then secondly, what's the situation in New York with recreational marijuana?
Yeah.
And number three, if there's time, where do you see transparency and accountability movements going, both at the state and federal level? It's kind of embarrassing being from a, knowing that our governor's, people are going to jail, and also the president's people are going to jail. It's uninspiring for those of us interested in governing.
Great questions. Okay, 3-part question. So I think on the first one, again, I go back to your question. I think, you know, those instances and those moments are things that hopefully then will provide some sustaining fuel to the effort to reform and change our voting systems at the state levels. That, you know, when states get embarrassed by these things, hopefully there's a reaction to that, and you know, I don't know if I have much else to say about it, but that's what I would say. That I think, again, those are things that activists can point to as they go forward and say, "Here's the problem that you know we need to deal with." The second question was about the third one. Was that recreational marijuana, right? Yeah, that was one I should have put on my list of low-hanging fruit. Yeah, I think that's here. I think that's going to come here. And I think once it comes here, then I think it's simply a matter of time until you get a Democratic president again, which will happen at some point, that we get it across the country. Because it's just, you get to these tipping points on this. And I think California was the big one. But then if you get New York, and remember, we're basically surrounded right now by recreational marijuana, right? Vermont has it. They don't have dispensaries, but they have recreational marijuana. They went in a different direction. You sort of have to grow your own or get it from a friend or whatever. But they've got it as of July 1st. They basically had it anyway, but now they have it on paper. Massachusetts has recreational marijuana, and they've got dispensaries. And they had lines around the door in Northampton, you know, to get in there on day one. I think the mayor was the first one in line. So I think that's a fact. And we've got it in Canada. So, you know, I can't imagine that this is not going to happen here. And so I think that would be one of the pieces of low-hanging fruit. The big problem with that one, by the way, and there's figuring it out, and Colorado's struggling with it and all that, well, two problems. One is, and I'm getting into the details here, but it's how you handle the edibles, because that's where people kind of, particularly if they don't know what they're doing, they can really, you know, the Maureen Dowd sort of thing. Did you remember that column? She went to Colorado, ate the whole candy bar, you know, anyway, had a bad night. And then the other piece, of course, is the driving, you know. But the thing I've always said about this, and again, I'll sound like I'm editorializing, but when you look at the both the data on the problems regarding this and the harms regarding this, and then the, also the predicted ones. You have to compare it to alcohol. And when you compare it to alcohol, again, they're not even in the same solar system. I mean, just the and I'm not sounding like a prohibitionist here. I think we've had that experiment. It didn't work. But the social damage that is caused by alcohol, I mean, it will take centuries before marijuana ever matches that. So I just, you know, I think that needs to be borne in mind. And the other, transparency and ethics, national level and state level. Again, I think that, you know, it's the perennial thing in this state that gets pushed by reform advocates and by activists, and I think this is now finally the window that is open to do something more significant. I think it's quite possible that we might have some kind of voluntary public financing scheme. I think it's likely that we're going to have more restrictions on the funding. I mean, we have some of the least restrictions on state campaign funding and contributions in the country. I think it's likely there'll be something there. I think that it's likely that there'll be some changes in terms of the ethics and how they are policed within the legislature. I think those things are likely to change. At the national level, I wouldn't expect anything. I just don't think anything significant is going to happen in the next 2 years. I hope I'm wrong. But I think that the prediction is, I think that it will be irresistible for the Democrats in the House to really start now pushing this kind of impeachment or something, hopefully leading to uncovering something for impeachment. It will take forever. It will just dig in everybody even further. And in the end, probably, if we're talking about tactics and strategy, ultimately will help the president. So that's what I see there.
I've got a question over here.
My question is about local media coverage of elections.
Is there?
Yeah, well.
I was cheeky, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Stan, I'm sorry, that was just cheeky.
We were watching a local story on false and misleading campaign claims.
Yes.
In our House election.
Yes, there were.
And we thought, well, you know, this is interesting.
Yeah.
And then there was an example of how CATCo had been misrepresented, and then I'm waiting for the counterexample of how Dana Balter and her campaign had been misrepresented, and it wasn't there. And I'm wondering, this was Channel 3, I think 3 or 5, and we know that those two stations were taken over by Sinclair.
All right.
So I'm wondering if you saw a connection there, and if there's anything else we should do besides going to PBS and maybe Channel 9 for our news.
Well, let me answer it in a broader way, I guess, and that is that, and Syracuse is not different from most other local places in this regard, but the bigger problem is that there just isn't very much substantive coverage of our of local elections. I mean, the congressional races get some, but it's hard because, and you know, and I have empathy for this person, but you know, the main person covering this is not even here physically most of the time. So it's just in the paper, so it's tough. And so
seem better than the TV.
Yeah, well, yeah, and they've got more time and more space to work with. Basically the television's just gonna be repeating what the candidates are saying back and forth. I mean, that's all they have time for. You know,
this was a news story.
News story that on the analysis and a fact check.
And balance.
Right. Well, that sounds like, and I can't say definitively that the other fact check wasn't there, so I can't really engage with you on that specific fact point. If what you're saying is true, then yeah, that was a problem, and it seems like that was a problem for the at an editorial level that, you know, that definitely should have had attention. The claims that were made, some of the claims that were made in the races here were really disappointing, I think. And frankly, and again, editorializing, I think out of character for some of the people involved. And it left me pretty puzzled. And so I have guesses as to what was driving that. I think probably there were people that were listening too much to people from Washington that didn't understand the district. I think maybe there was fear about, oh, I'm looking at some poll numbers I don't like the look of early on. We're going to have to go this way. But that's still on the candidates and the campaigns. They ultimately approve that stuff in one way or another. And so I've said this all along, and I say it again. One of the other problems is voters rarely hold candidates accountable for an election that they ran before. And I think voters need to do that.
Yeah, we called.
If you see something, I've told people this before. There's so many different ways to vote, right? You can have one policy issue that drives you. You know, I'm most concerned about taxes, and that's going to be the thing. Or I try to take the whole measure of the person. Or I've got a set of policy issues, and I look for the best overall fit. But there's another thing to do, which is, what is your behavior during the campaign? I don't think it is epiphenomenal. I think it's totally legitimate for a citizen to say, I'm going to put that right near the top, because that's one of the things I'm most concerned about in my civic life. And I don't think it is inappropriate then for a voter to either do one of two things. There's a candidate that you voted for, but you didn't like the way he or she ran their campaigns and you didn't like their messaging. Go ahead and vote for them, and then get on the phone and say, hey, I voted for you, but I am telling you I did not appreciate what you said about your opponent and the way that you said it. And you are not necessarily going to get my vote next time. That will get their attention. Or to write them and say, you know what, you had my vote for two other elections, you didn't get it this time, and here's the reason why. And you're not going to get it next time if you do this again.
So we call the campaign voters, the campaign headquarters.
Yeah, that's, you should do that. Yeah, you should do that.
I noticed that for 3 days we didn't see a particular day.
Yeah, you should do that. Here's the other thing I'd say is, and we have time for this. I am totally editorializing. I've written about this before. I think I do have a solution to this, okay? And it's not something that is ever done in the United States. Well, it's been done a couple times in a couple states, but very weakly. In addition to making it July 4th, the other thing I would do is I would have a real none of the above in every single election as an option. And here's the way it would work. You have none of the above, and the hope ultimately by having none of the above is that very few people will vote for none of the above. But the reason why you have it there and the way it will work is this. If none of the above comes in first, doesn't have to get a majority, it's like a plurality, like the way we do our elections now. If none of the above comes in first, then you have another new election in that district in which the two candidates who ran are ineligible to run again. Okay? And why I think this is a good idea is that it will put some teeth into then, there's a real downside now that candidates have to consider when they're going to engage in this kind of deliberately misleading information. That they have to think, wait a minute, it's not just my opponent here. It's also the disgust button that I may be forcing people to push, and that's going to really hurt me. I'd love to see that reform. I think it would change. I really do think it would change the dynamic of the elections, but unfortunately, that idea just doesn't have any traction here in the United States.
You're a professor.
Okay.
I understand, or at least I think I understand, the rationale for the Electoral College when it was implemented.
Yeah, boy.
Is it really still relevant today, or is it a hindrance on voting and voter attitudes going forward?
Okay, wow. Just a short question at the end. The Electoral College in 5 minutes. All right, so I'm going to presume in my answer that there is a general familiarity with the Electoral College and how it works. Otherwise, I could not answer this question in 5 minutes. So, having made that assumption, one of the knocks on it, first of all, one thing to say is, there's nothing written in stone that it can't be a proportional election, okay? 48 out of the 50 states, well, and 40, including District of Columbia, now 49 out of the 51, are choosing to make it winner take all. They could change it tomorrow, right? Maine and Nebraska or Maine and Kansas? who knows, Nebraska. Maine and Nebraska don't have winner take all, and Donald Trump got one electoral vote in Maine, okay, and Hillary Clinton won the other two or three. So states could change that tomorrow. So first of all, you could put that on the states in terms of how it actually works. Setting that aside, let's just say it's winner take all in each state. So the knock on it is that you have a small handful of battleground states, and the other states really, in a sense, don't matter because again, we're so polarized and we're so geographically separated. It's the Cracker Barrel problem again at the state level. Okay, that's what's going on in our country. So there's 10 states where the presidential election really happens. All right, that's the criticism. And then you also have this weird quirk that we saw in 2016, that if you have a bunch of really close wins and then your opponent racks up these huge wins in these other big states, you could win the Electoral College while your opponent wins the popular vote. I'm not so exercised over that as other people are, but anyway. So here's the thing that you could say in favor of the 10 battleground state things. And here I'm being, none of you are gonna agree with me on this. But here's the defense of the Electoral College in today's world. It doesn't make sense for what the founders were thinking, right? The founders were thinking, first of all, you can't really trust the public completely, so there has to be a filtering mechanism. Secondly, they did not anticipate the rise of the two-party system to really drive the thing, so they thought that it was going to be very unlikely that you were going to get sort of these consensus candidates emerging organically out of the process across the 13 colonies, and so you needed some transfer mechanism in order to have sort of people who kind of knew the usual suspects and could make the... There were reasons for that they didn't anticipate. They didn't get right. But let's imagine that we did just have a popular vote. We just got rid of it. And we did it like other countries. We had a popular vote. What would the dynamic of that presidential election be? Just think about it for a minute. Where would the attention be? Where would this election be focused? What kind of election would we have? Remember what I started when I talked about the results. Where did the Democrats make their big gains? Suburbs. That's where the competition's gonna be. So I think if we had a popular vote national election, this is the argument I would make in favor of the Electoral College, which no one will buy, is that if we had a popular vote national election, this would become an election of the suburbs. All the attention would be on the suburbs. That's where the candidates would go. That's where the promises would be made. That's how the policies would be structured and organized. And that's the kind of connection that the candidate would have to make. And those are the kind of candidates that would do well in both parties, people who could relate to suburbs. At least with the 10-state thing we have now, you've got a collection of states that represent different cultures and parts of the country that matter, okay? Colorado matters, Nevada matters, right? Ohio matters, Pennsylvania matters, Michigan matters, New Hampshire matters. These are all different states. No place in the South matters because they're all solidly Republican, but maybe, I don't know, maybe Georgia at some point. So, you know, the point I'm making here is that at least it forces the candidates in the general election to go see different parts of the country and to make appeals to different types of people and to be able and to have to talk to rural people, urban people, and suburban people because those are all in those battleground states. If you get rid of the Electoral College, it's all going to be focused on the suburbs of Houston, the suburbs of New York, the suburbs of Los Angeles, Chicago. And that's pretty homogeneous. And so that would be the argument I would make. Same argument that you make, and sorry, last thing. Same argument that you can make in favor of our crazy primary system. It doesn't make any sense when you look at it. Why should Iowa and New Hampshire, two states that don't look like the rest of the country at all, drive the primary process so deeply and get so much attention? It's the reason why we have ethanol in our gas. Right? This is on the West Wing. Yeah, it's got to be true. It's a stupid program. It can't be really defended. But the reason why we have it is because Iowa is the first primary, and everyone's got to take that pledge that they're going to continue that program. Remember when the President Bartlett had to, you know, he said, "I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it." And his advisors talked him into doing it, and then he did it. Right? I mean, that wasn't that far off from the truth. But at least the thing that the Iowa and New Hampshire process does is it forces people for a year to go into diners and to talk to people 15, 20, 30 at a time and to be able to make that connection. And the media is watching and they're reporting on it. And so at least it does that. If we had a national primary, like a lot of reformers would want, it would be strictly a television affair and a social media affair, and you would not at least force that person to go into that diner and sit down and talk to that person about what their situation is. Maybe all that stuff goes in one ear and out the other at the candidates, but I hope somehow it doesn't. So that's the defense of the way things are.
All right, please join me in thanking Grant Wood.